This is tape number two of Where the Bodies Are Buried 2020, copyright 1996 by Kim Newman, read by Goblin Hood. It takes up in just about the middle of the story. My vows oblige me to forgive you your sins, but not forget them. You may leave by the gangway and fish out your wet friend. Good day. The kids bolted. Subotai nodded impassive thanks and returned to whatever he had been doing. We were lucky, she told Jerome. Modellists wouldn't have been seen off so easily. Religion gives a lot of idiots strength. Jerome was admiring her. Chan, I can't decide whether you remind me more of Audrey Hepburn in The Nun's Story or Diana Rigg in The Avengers. I'm sorry, those references don't mean anything to you, do they? She laughed. He always forgot her culture. Her field was pop culture. In Switzerland, The Avengers is called Bowler Hat and Kinky Boots. It was on all the time when I was little. And every woman with the calling has to see The Nun's Story when they're nine. I saw it back to back with The Red Shoes and was torn between becoming a saint or a prima ballerina. Durock's head sat on the plate. Chantal and Jerome held still, so their faces were caught in the link beams. Agitated talkers lost ears and noses over holos. Over holo. The Hackwill killer is in the city, Durock said. We're conferencing with Keys tomorrow, Jerome said. Can you tap in from Barcelona? It is not likely, Durock replied. Thy report will be accepted. His face was blank. He accepted Holo, but virtual conference was too close to mimesis. She wondered if he was tempted to sample a dream. She and Jerome dipped in and out of Where the Bodies Are Buried all the time, but Durock was required by contract with the teleministry to abjure mimesis. The modellist must at least be curious. He was still human. The head vanished. His cop genes are taking over, Jerome said. These cases were his specialty. With his background, IPOL Barcelona must be glad to have Durock. From his involvement with the Machon, DL, and Best cases, he was up to speed on Hackwill killers. He knows about us, she said. Durock? The killer. He's following ECOM. The first murder was just after the Modell-Duff Amendment was proposed. Janine Szatho, the Budapest victim. All the killings have been inside the E-Union. If Modell-Duff becomes law, it will only be enforced within the EU. Gets bigger every year. If Libya is admitted, it'll open up the rest of North Africa. The only holdout is your place. There are no Swiss victims. He's killed from Gibraltar to Greenland, from Ankara to Yeltsingrad. Why not Zurich or Tel Aviv or Cuba? The day after Bermuda came in, he killed there. It's as if he's drawing a map. He doesn't want to go through passport control. He'd have needed a passport to get to Bermuda before killing McCarran. you're beginning to sound like a Hackwill killer yourself. Do you really think Rob Hackwill is talking to you? This is real, Weld, Jerome. I'm sorry, Shan. I'll have to process this. You have to admit, it scans paranoid at first scroll through. You, me, and Duroc, we're between two huge grinding cliffs of credit. On the one side, a hugely wealthy industry. The Derek Leach Group is richer than most countries. On the other, the relatives of Hackwill victims, underwritten by the Modellist Teleministry. These killings have been going on since the last century. If Modell Duff gets on the statutes in the EU, RHV will bring multiple suits. If cases go their way, there will be a credit transfer bigger than the one that caused the Nikkei crash of 2014. I know all this, Chan. We have to focus on micro issues. The amendment, we recommend or not on its own merits. Think of the victims. Think of the victims who are still alive, who haven't been born yet. The idea wasn't original to Joseph Modell and Murag Duff. It had been proposed in America as early as the 1990s. It was to do with blame and compensation. If murderers were shaped, not born, then the forces which influenced them should share culpability. If a rapist's mind was warped by pornography, then a rape victim should be able to sue pornographers. The Modell-Duff Amendment proposed moral guilt be brought under a legal remit. It was a simple, appealing idea, yet it frightened her. The Barcelona victim was called Armando de Castro Oros. Duroc downloaded stats before the news nets got them. Hours before the scheduled virtual conference, Chantal was praying for guidance. No matter how she tried to clear her mind, De Castro Oros remained. The boy was found dressed as a schoolgirl, face coated with asphyxiating plastic. Post-mortem, his murderer had cracked the fast-setting mask and jammed in a chocolate beetle. The victim's tears were trapped bubbles in the plastic. He was a Stacy, like Victor McCarran, Sarah Matsella, and Laura Petitic. The killer was repeating victim types. Tina's, Stacy's, Jimmy Trainor's, Judge Jonathan's, Boss Hooper's, all the characters from the dream. There was no other connection between De Castro Oros and where the bodies are buried. If there was a black market dream sphere in Barcelona, IPOL had not found it. Duroc was returning to Prague by way of Bermuda, where he wanted to follow up on McCarran. An American tourist, the Bermuda victim, might have been a smuggler responsible for getting the dream spheres into the EU in the first place. For Chantal, prayer was a communion. Like Jerome processing random info bits, she could sometimes run through the elements of a problem and be led to a conclusion in something approaching a vision. Not today. Chantal would have been satisfied with a HoloLink, swapping Tridvid with Beverly Hills Pyramid, wanting to impress Ecom with tech, insisted on a fancier virtual conference. They were to meet Alan Keyes in Spring Meadow. Jerome, excited, explained the body's dream belt could be accessed as a non-narrative CG environment. It was a supplementary feature of Home Mimesis Dreamscape Dreamspheres, along with a bound copy of the script and collector's cards. Jerome sat on the couch adjusting his hood set. He had already helped her plumb in. "You won't be a dead book this time, Shan. You'll have autonomy." "But I'll still be Tina." Jerome nodded, hood set bulbous. "Since bodies is a single viewpoint dream, so will I." Her eyepieces descended, blanking her vision. A test signal blipped into her brain. "Ready?" Jerome asked. She was back in the park, standing before the statue, waiting for midnight. As she slipped into the Tina simile, Chantal prepared for a mind link that did not come. For a moment, she thought the puppet's strings were cut and she would fall in a tangle. Then she was in control. She was herself, but with Tina's dream body. By the statue stood a pretty girl in a heavy coat and a wool scarf. She smiled and shrugged. "Weird," Jerome commented through the pretty girl's mouth. "This gets stranger." Jerome, as Tina, looked a little different from the self-image of Chantal as Tina. She saw Jerome's slenderness in his simile, even an underlay of his cheekbones in the Tina face. She wondered if Alan Keyes and the Pyramid CEO would also be forced to be Tina's. Probably not. At their end, they would have more sophisticated dream tech and should be able to select viewpoints to suit themselves. She looked around, dream flesh creeping. "What's up, Shan? There's someone here. They're not online yet." "No, not them." He glanced about too and shrugged. His distinctive smile stretched the Tina face. "It's the first scene feeling from the dream," she explained. "When Hackwill is creeping up on Tina." "The story isn't in, Ron. For once. The story isn't in, Ron. For once, there's no Robbie here. There's always a Hackwill in Spring Meadow." "Aha. Judge Jonathan's speech. You're a body's buff. I keep forgetting." Beep tone came from their coats. Jerome found his set book before Chantal found hers. Both lit up with identical messages. "The old Hackwill place. Do you want to walk or skip that?" she said. They both blinked. "Transitional fade." And were outside the dark, scary house. Stacy, a walking mannequin, was waiting for them on the porch. She had blots of rouge on white plastic cheeks.
Mr. Rhodes, Ms. Jurat,
she said through stiff, barely parted lips.
I'm MediaCom of Pyramid Releasing. We're proud to have you in Spring Meadow.
The similes shook hands. Medea's fingers were hard and unmoving.
Sorry about this. I had hoped to rep myself as the Stacy of her cute scenes, not the Stacy Quinn. I actually look a little like the babe version, but we had a simile transfer glitch. The bugs will be worked out prontissimo. It's cutting edge tech.
Chantal had expected a pyramid exec to be more like the devil princess.
Alan is inside, waiting.
Medea hobbled lopsided into the mansion. Jerome hung back a little to let Chantal in first. The hallway was as it was in the finale, hellfire burn marks on the wall. Someone stood in the dark at the top of the stairs.
Alan,
said Medea as Stacy Quinn.
Mr. Rhodes and Ms. Jurat are from the Euro Commission on the Model Duff Amendment.
I've scrolled your thesis, sister, said Keyes. You make some points. He stepped forward into the light. Chantal had expected Keyes to be Hackwill, but the talent was in the simile of Japheth. Jonathan, the corrupt judge who explains Hackwill's origins. Thankfully, he was not as last seen in the dream, head exploded by his own tongue swollen to the size of a watermelon. But as in his intro scene, Keyes must be about Jonathan's age, but News Sims did not suggest other resemblance. The judge was an impressively eyebrowed character actor. Keyes was one of those nondescript Englishmen. Jerome grown not old, but faint. One of the Hackwill victims was Key's own girlfriend. It must take something to continue weaving nightmares after that. Originally a novelist, Keyes had turned himself into a motion picture director and then a mimesis talent, extending the reign of Hackwill into fresh media. How does a Jesuit get to know so much about horror films? He asked.
My field of study is media influence. Genre horror is central to the discipline. The pioneer work of Martin Barker and Julian Petley in the 1990s.
But do you like horror? Do you like what I do? She tried to give an honest answer.
While working on my thesis, I became so familiar with the material that I lost perspective on aesthetic or entertainment quality. But I first decided to be a Jesuit because of The Exorcist. As a child, I saw the original Where the Bodies Are Buried. It was made the year I was born. On Cloud 9 TV, it gave me nightmares for weeks, but I pleaded with my parents to let me watch it again.
your thesis could do with input from the little girl you once were. I intuit you regret a weakness for the films because of the Hackwill effect. Pyramid releasing does not acknowledge the existence of the so-called Hackwill effect, Medea cut in. Many studies, including your own Sister Jewelerat, question a hypothesized causal relationship between fictional and real world violence. Our guests aren't interested in blip quotes, Medea, Keys said. Credit them with that. Medea continued, if you lump together so-called Hackwill killings over the last 25 years, including those later established as unconnected, you have at most 400 murders. 5 times that many died in the Reverend Modell's Warsaw pogrom last year. And what about British druids, mustard gassed by special branch in the solstice of 79? Joseph Modell and Morag Duff should look to their own consciences. The lecture was pointed, but sounded strange from a life-size broken doll. You've obviously given the Hackwill effect thought, Chantel said to Keys. Yet you've continued with bodies. It can't just be for the credit. Why do you do it? Why do you create only horrors? Keys smiled sadly. What makes you think I have a choice? All around, hellfire exploded.
Interference?
The similes could be hurt. These flames bit harder than the pain analogs usual in dreams. Consciousness unfiltered through viewpoint. She was immersed in intense heat, blinding light, choking stench, nipping agony. Jerome was patting out the flames on her arm. Medea had vanished, presumably breaking the link. Half of Jerome's Tina hair was singed off. A burning beam fell between them and Keys. He stood still in the inferno. She wondered if his simile was an empty freeze frame, but his eyes moved. The laughter of the devil princess poured out of the air, setting fires wherever it was heard. In the original, only the mansion was destroyed. In the dream make, most of Spring Meadow was consumed. Windows burst outwards. Drafts of cold air whipped flames into spirals that entwined the two Tinas. Chantel and Jerome hugged as if the heroine wanted to reunite her divided self.
Another glitch?
Jerome asked. In the fire behind Keys, a black shape coalesced, rearing up over him. Arms enfolding the talent, bands of clawed shadow held him fast. A single red eye shone, a crystal of fire in a man-shaped patch of night.
Keys!
She shouted. Jerome thumped his own forehead, where the hood-set panel was in real welt. He disappeared. She was alone in Spring Meadow with Keys and the Hackwill effect. Fire rushed to fill the place where Jerome's Tina had been. Alan Keys, she could swear, smiled with almost relief as the shadow and flame wrapped around him. This was the end of his private dream story.
Stop!
Jerome was pulling the hood set off her. Half his face was an angry red. She looked at her hands and saw white spots where cinders had scalded her in Spring Meadow. Subotai was checking the fixed-up link, genuinely concerned for his temporary masters. She intuited she had just experienced the downside of cutting-edge tech. "Do we still have audio link?" she asked Subotai. The robota stood aside and gave her the handset. Jerome was swearing profusely in English, touching his pain patches. He was burned under unsinged clothes. "Hello," she said to the handset. "Ms. Calm? Keys?" There was a commotion at the other end. "Miss Jewelrat," came a voice, a woman, shaky. "Medea?"
Yes, we have no rationale for that, incident.
"Is Keys out of the dream?" "We've cut him off. He's here. His body's here. But there's nobody home."
It was site prime in the weeks leading up to Halloween. Alan Keys, the Hackwill man, was the latest victim of the Hackwill effect. His body might live, but he was mind-wiped, a human blank. Medicos theorized that if he came out of coma, he might develop from mental infancy, growing a new personality. But it was a moot point. He had suffered 78% burns in the virtual conference. If he came round, he would probably die from pain trauma. From the deck, Chantal looked down on gray waters. A drift of ground-hugging riot gas seeped down from the bridge, floating on the surface of the Vltava. She felt after-sting in her nostrils, even though the domino mask she wore when the pollution count was high. Where the bodies are buried had been recalled. Ecom had to surrender their dream sphere to a notarized messenger, and Mimesis was on hold until bugs can be ironed out. Whatever the truth of the Hackwill effect, Keys was proof that mimesis could be hazardous to dreamers' health, mental and otherwise. Ecom's ground was out from under them. The original unexpressed purpose of the inquiry, beyond even the amendment, was to determine whether mimesis be allowed unrestricted into E-Union. Now, mimesis was withdrawn by the industry. If Model Duff passed, it would apply only to old-fashioned media tech like motion pictures, telly, and VR. Not newsworthy, but still a major legislative shift. Using the railing as a bar, Chantal ran through ballet moves, stretching her legs until they felt real, making points of her toes. With the troubles, she was advised not to go jogging up to the castle and back, as she had in Ecom's early days in the city. The Mayrink sometimes felt like a prison. She needed to maintain strength and suppleness. Exercise was a courtesy to God. It was her duty to maintain in peak condition the wonderful gift of a body her soul had been given. As she felt the knots popping in her muscles and joints, she thought it over. Durok, back from his travels, was meticulously assembling an info dump about the current Hackwill killings. He had taken their report of the conference on board, but had no ideas about it. To him, Mimesis' dreams were hell equivalents even without brimstone. Jerome thought it a glitch, bleed through from the narrative of bodies, but Chantal was convinced there had been another presence in Spring Meadow. It was hard not to think of it as Rob Hackwill. On the Charles Bridge, the demonstration turned ugly. Students supporting persecuted refugees
clashed with Modellists, and armed police were caught between them. People fell or were tossed off the bridge, splashing in gas-covered water. Throwing malcontents into the river was a traditional Prague response to trouble, just as throwing bureaucrats out of windows was a traditional Prague way of making trouble. Last night, the head of the local Modellist congregation had been defenestrated. She stopped her program of kicks and toweled her sweaty forehead. Through the dominoes, she breathed deeply. The McDonald's airport was shut down. Transnational HoloLinks were out. After the ghetto riots, Modellist advance teams combed the ruins, offering salvation with share options and low monthly payments. Subotai had heard a whisper that ECOM would have to share the Mayrink with the Europa Defense Force Response Unit straight from Cadiz. Jerome came up on deck looking sheepish, turfed out of his hotel by a Newsnet anchor. He was mooching around the ship, face glistening from the healing gel he had to wear until his burns faded. "Shan, I've made my decision." She had expected this. The Spring Meadow incident had shaken him, and the December deadline was approaching. She pulled off her domino so she could speak with him. "I'm voting the amendment be attached to the revised criminal code," he said. "That aligns me with Roger."
"I see."
It didn't have to be unanimous. She still felt the inquiry should be pursued. Mimesis might even prove a side issue to the greater question.
"As of now, I can't change my position," she said.
"Still Swiss?"
She took the railing and kicked in the air above Jerome's head. She had always had trick hips.
"I abstain. You know why."
"I'm sorry, Shan."
She went below decks to tell Durok. At her knock, he unlocked his door. Aside from the bunk, his cabin was furnished only with a flat screen and a knee rest. An official holo bust of Reverend Modell hovered under the bare light strip. Durok worked always under the blind gaze of his master. He stood aside to let her in. They both had to bow slightly because of the low ceiling. Durok blithely dipped his head through Modell, but Chantal avoided the holo as if it were a solid. Durok, alarmingly, was stripped to the waist. His back was striped with scars, some fresh. He had a scourge in his hand, a wicked cluster of studded flails with a riding crop grip. She had not realized Durok was a flagellant. On the flat screen were images Chantal recognized, a field laid out neatly with corpses, black-clad Modellists prowling among the dead. "The Basque insurrection?" she asked. Durok nodded. Most who had served in the insurrection were soured on Modellists for life. There was a famous incident in which a non-com was court-martialed for disobeying orders and intervening to cut short a massacre supervised by elders of the tele-ministry. Durok must be Modell's only convert from the EDF. No wonder he felt the need to whip himself.
"Jerome's changed his vote to yes."
Durok nodded, understanding.
"I'll prep a formal statement for Brussels. We all put our signatures to it. Then we can go home."
"Hast thou changed thy vote?"
"It doesn't have to be unanimous." I know. He looked at her. She saw something hanging back in his eyes, but could not process it. Yes, she admitted. I have changed my vote from abstention to no. She did not ask if Duroc wanted to change his yes to abstention or no. That would have been futile. I'm sorry, sister. We must all act in accordance with our conscience. He looked sideways at the model head, as if seeking higher approval. The decision was communicated on a priority line to Brussels, and the Model Duff Amendment was attached to the revised criminal code. On New Year's Eve, Joseph Model held a celebratory rally in Vaduz. In his speech, he personally commended Chantal Jouerat, Jerome Rhodes, and brother Roger Duroc as good credit Christians. He claimed their heavenly portfolios were maturing exceptionally well, throwing off high-yield interests. He also promised arms to the advance teams in Prague and accused Tel Aviv of inciting ghetto dwellers to murder their Modelist rescuers. The ECOM, officially dissolved, was still in Prague. Travel restrictions were in force until the fighting died down. On New Year's Day, there was a Hackwill killing outside the castle. Pavel Zaradnik, a boss hooper, head burned to the skull. His wife signed up with RHV, the Model Duff Amendment. No, the Model Duff Law was retroactive. Petra Zaradnik would have to join a queue of grieving, suing relatives. The conglomerated lawsuit was already issued, and Pyramid's corporate attorneys were resisting attempts to bring the case to the European court in Kiev. Morag Duff, under fire for imposing an extension of the term between general elections to 10 years, gloried in the success of her amendment. She carefully never mentioned Model in public, and announced she would now devote herself to removing nudity from art galleries and British World Tree sites, with lewdness and license expunged, she claimed, repeating her last electoral slogan, "Everything will be nice again." Chantal kept her cabin when the EDF unit moved in, but Duroc and Jerome had to bunk together. Subotai was pounced upon in the square and severely beaten by Modelists. He was then removed to a camp in the Carpathians, where Czech's Chancellor Dernkova claimed refugees could be protected from violent mobs. Duroc did not take part in any of his church's activities in the city, and shutters came down whenever the soldiers talked about the militia missionaries against whom they expected to be deployed. Cardinal Menzies communicated that she was expected back in Rome when restrictions were lifted. She passed time with her breviary, unable to shift her mind from the dead issue of ECOM to her next task, finishing her Information Children book file. She still sensed, just out of sight, the creature of flame and darkness that had attacked Alan Keyes in Spring Meadow. "What are you scanning?" Jerome asked. On deck, the EDF were doing push-ups. Duroc, 20 years older than most of the soldier kids, was earning respect by matching them thrust for thrust. Jerome was frustrated. He missed spending the holidays with his mother. It seemed he would not get out of Czechia before spring. Also, he was off salary. "I'm going through our logs, checking the hours we put in at terminals and in meetings." "You think we've been rooked on our expenses?" "Something nags." close it down, Chan. It's processed and perfected. We did our bit. Now it's up to lawyers. On St. Valentine's Day, Subotai escaped from the relocation center and made his way to Prague, where, according to the news nets, he was waylaid by the Hackwheel killer. He was a Judge Jonathan, head burst by a pressure capsule, intended for instant life raft inflation, forced into his mouth. Chantal was shocked and depressed. She liked and trusted the robota. Subotai's scattered family and several women who repped themselves as his wives, but whose claims were instantly disproved, joined the RHV and added their lawsuits to the others. She intuited the case would not come to Kiev until the Hackwheel killer was caught. Alan Key's condition remained stable. On the Mayrink, it was hard to concentrate. She kept going over the logs of the e-com. Jerome, suffering cabin fever, had taken to complaining about foreigners. The EDF, mostly Turks and Swedes, were growing nervy as their deployment was put off. Everyone was getting irritable, except Duroc. He exercised, read Modellist screen texts, and showed no interest in the world outside his faith. It was Jerome who pointed out the anomaly. It's odd. Roger traipsed from Spain to Bermuda on the trail of the Hackwheel killer, but hasn't crossed the river to join the hunt. Now the murderer is in Prague. I'm surprised I, Paul, haven't conscripted him to head the investigation. Just around midnight on March 1st, the alarum sounded. One moment, Chantal was in the Mayrink's mess hall, improving her Swedish by chatting with a non-com from Malmo. Then she was surrounded by Marie-Celeste, detritus of abandoned card games and unfinished mugs of recaf. The clattering of boots was a brief thunder. The ship actually rocked as the EDF unit assembled on one side of the deck. They yomped out, weighed down by weaponry, towards the ghetto. She prayed for their safety and for those they would be fighting. Through the mess windows, she saw a glow in the sky. She had a flash of the old Hackwheel place. "They're burning the ghetto," Jerome said. "The bloody fools. Modellist maniacs." Duroc was with them, showing no emotion. Jerome turned on the Modellist. "How can you be with those bloodthirsty credit grubbers?" "The Reverend Modell tells us we must terminate unrewarding investments. Only radical measures will serve." "You can't really believe that, scut." Duroc went up on deck. In prayer, it came to her, the discrepancy that had been nagging was Duroc's trip to Barcelona. She had to check first. "Where are you going, Chan?" She left Jerome in the mess hall and made her way down a deck. The office was sealed, but she still had a viable entry code. She called up the logs on the terminal and scrolled them side by side with a newsnet chronology of the killings. Jerome was in the doorway, puzzled. She was glad he had followed her. The ship lurched. A noise hammered. An explosion ashore, nearby. There was the popping of gunfire. She concentrated on the screen, shutting out the macro issues. "Chan, what is it?" "Look,
Duroc arrived in Barcelona before Armando de Castro Oros was murdered. He had an eyeball tip-off?
No, he's the Hackwill killer.
There was a thump. She turned from the screen and looked at Jerome's face. He was open-mouthed and wide-eyed, stunned. A trickle of blood came from his hairline. He stood statue still, then pitched forwards. Duroc, spanner in hand, stepped over Jerome and looked at her.
I'm not a Hackwill killer, he said. There are no Hackwill killers.
As a teenager, ballet had led for a while to martial arts. She saw the point in the center of Duroc's solid chest where she should kick. She stood slowly, tense, but trying to calm herself. She knew she had no chance. Besides his training as a soldier, a policeman, and a fanatic, Duroc was a practiced murderer. She could not hope to fight him.
Undoing the Lord's work, he said deadpan, as revealed to me by the Reverend Modell, we must put away evil things.
Was he mocking her? He held the spanner loosely, thwacking his open palm with the heavy instrument. Would she be a Tina or a... He held the spanner loosely, thwacking his open palm with the heavy instrument. Would she be a Tina or a Stacy? He was a barrier in the doorway. That left her with one other option. She made her move, grabbing the terminal chair and rolling it across the deck towards Duroc. It slammed him, not hurting at all, but distracting. Chantal jumped and grasped with both hands a pipe that ran across the ceiling. She swung back and forth twice like an aerialist, feeling the wrench in her shoulders, then aimed herself feet first at the porthole. She was, thank God, wearing sensible shoes and a single piece. Her points punched the circle of glass out of the hole, and she followed through, body like a dart, praying hips or shoulders would not catch. Fire raked her back as she plunged through the porthole, scraping herself on the rim. Her whole body was out in cold night when her wrists were grabbed. Her shoulders exploded. Angry ants ate at the muscles from inside. For an instant, she thought her arms had come off. Duroc held her, but her whole weight dragged her down. She slammed against the Mayrink's steel hull. Bursts of shadow and flame obscured her vision field. This time, she was not a viewpoint. This was real welt, with real pain and real death. Her weight and momentum hauled Duroc partially out of the porthole. She looked up at his face and saw only shadow. The sky above the ship was crimson streaked. Somewhere else, guns were going off. Duroc held her by the wrists, but couldn't haul her up without adjusting his grip.
You never dreamed where the bodies are buried, she said through pain. You told me you never even saw the old film.
That is true.
Was it the Hackwill killers you caught? You've been recreating their crimes?
There are no Hackwill killers.
It hit her that Pietro Michonne, Nadja Thiel, and Hugh Best were innocent.
Roger Duroc had framed them for earlier murder clusters.
Roger, why?
A fire burst illuminated the side of the ship, casting their harsh shadows on the hull. In red light, she glimpsed an upside-down smile playing around Duroc's lips.
Sister, the Lord showed me the way through Joseph Modell.
He dropped her. She plunged into the filthy, flat Latava and felt she touched bottom before air in her lungs buoyed her. She struggled up through thick, freezing water. The ripples above were blobbed with reflected fire bursts. When she broke the surface, her ears were roaring. She swam to the bank, found an iron ring inset in a concrete wall, and pulled herself up, sopping, onto a jetty. Her single piece stuck to her like a layer of clogged ice. She wanted to curl up and get warm, but she had left Jerome with Duroc. She found the gangplank and ran up it, leaving dripping footsteps.
Duroc!
She shouted. A bullet spanged against the hull of the Mayrink. A powerboat passed by, raising a white froth of wake. Someone fired another wild shot, not at her, but at the sky.
"Praise the Lord and shoot the sinners!"
shouted the boatman. She had no idea what that was about. She looked around for a weapon as she made her way down to the office deck. All she could find was a solid body guitar. One of the Turkish soldiers had left it behind. The corridor was quiet. She saw Jerome's legs stuck out of the doorway. They shifted as he was turned over. Heart clenched, she ran to the office. Duroc squatted by Jerome, examining his head wound.
"He'll be all right, sister."
She held the guitar by the neck, hefting it like a bludgeon.
"I've called the police. They're busy."
With all her strength, she smashed the guitar into Duroc, lifting him off the floor.
As Duroc fell backwards, Chantal stepped through the door. The lights went out and a chill fell on her. She blinked and held onto the neck of the broken guitar. She was not in the office with its burst porthole and dream deck, but back in the park in Spring Meadow. Duroc was sprawled at the base of the statue of the town founder. He was not Duroc, but Hackwill. Yet she was not Tina, but Chantal. She stood over the monster, wondering whether to end it by driving the guitar neck through his heart. You could not kill Hackwill. He always came back for the sequel. For some reason, the Modellist had been committing murders for years. Initially, he had used his position in IPOL to frame others, tagging them as Hackwill killers. It couldn't be the Hackwill effect, unless it were a new strain, a Hackwill effect by proxy. The monster was hurt, trying to lift himself. "I said we had work to do, sister," he said.
She held the guitar neck out like a crucifix to ward off evil. Duroc supported himself by clinging to the pedestal. Bloody spittle hung from his mouth. She guessed Duroc had intervened in the virtual conference,
projecting into the dream world through the thing of shadow and fire. He was playing some immense game plan. And she had a horrid intuition that mass murder and Ecom and Model Duff were merely facets of an intricate device whose purpose was not yet apparent. Darkness and fire were contained in Durak's thick chest, entwining his body with ropes of wavering black and red. He wore a transparent Hackwill mask. Behind it, his face was set. She tossed the guitar neck away and braced herself to fight. In this waking dream, she was herself. She was still wet and hurt. Pirouetting, she slammed her foot into his chest, imagining it a blunt knife, focusing her all into the kick. Durak coughed and thumped back against the statue. Her ankle was badly jarred, but she ignored pain, making triangular wedges of her fingers. She jabbed Durak's torso where she had kicked, probing for broken spots. Despite her blows, he stood up. "I do the Lord's work," he repeated. He was completely shrouded in flame and shadow. Heat seared and cold stung her hands as she hit him. His Hackwill mask was illuminated from within, as if his skull were red hot beneath translucent flesh. "May the Lord forgive you," she said. She punched him in the face and danced back away from him, knowing she couldn't keep this up much longer. At the edges of the park, the dead gathered, the dead of where the bodies are buried. Stacy, Jimmy, the judge, even Tina, and the dead of real Welt. Janine, Kasatho, Subotai, Martha, McCarran, Zaradnik, DeCastro Oros, mannequin-like, the broken witnesses hobbled together. Durak stood still, relaxing, head hung slightly. She felt her anger fading. Horror movie dead closed in, a shambling noose tightening around Chantal and Durak. Alan Keyes was there, a ghost in his own dream world, drifting above the grass. And the devil princess, hair like white flame spilling from her scarlet wimple. The dream was running down. "Where are we?" she asked.
"Outside, sister," the devil princess purred. "In Spring Meadow, where the bodies are buried."
Durak spread his arms in surrender. Feathers of flame ran along their undersides. Fire and darkness gathered in Durak's torso and coursed through his arms, exploding from his fingers, channeling into the dead, dissipating in the dream. Durak, empty, sagged at the knees, slumped at the feet of the statue. His face was pathetic, a childish plastic mask broken across. His claws had come off, too. Rob Hackwill was only Roger Duroc dressed up. Chantal stood over the murderer, feeling the tug of the real welt beginning. She knew now there was no Rob Hackwill, just a man who had killed in the monster's name. Suddenly, a laugh fell upon her from above, a laugh like a rain of hot pebbles. She knew instantly the cackle of the real Rob, the pure evil of the old movies thrived. Hackwill still lurked in dream spheres, scratching inside silver eggshell to be born into the real welt. She looked up from the fallen Duroc to the greened bronze boots of the town founder. The statue creaked to life. A clawed hand raised a sword. The burning red eye, the gnashing bloody teeth, the pouring laughter. Raised on his pedestal, Rob Hackwill ruled Spring Meadow. Chantal fell to her knees and locked her hands in prayer.
She was back on the May Rink, kneeling by the fallen Duroc, praying fiercely. She must work swiftly. As she tied Duroc up with cables from the dream deck, she worried at it in her mind. If it had been a vision, she intuited Duroc had shared it. Some of the dream had stuck in her mind and enveloped them both. Through Rob Hackwill, she was trying to tell herself something, trying to understand a mystery. Duroc, unconscious, was heavy and awkward. He came round while she was binding him, but did not struggle or try to talk. It was not over. When she was finished with Duroc, she checked on Jerome. He was breathing, but asleep. She sat exhausted and shivering against a bulkhead. Duroc watched her, as inexpressive as ever. "The Lord's work," he repeated. She tried to stop her teeth chattering. For the first time in 15 years, the Reverend Joseph Modell was unavailable for comment. In the castle, Czech Ipol interrogated the accused. Chantal and Jerome stood in the dark beyond the mirror watching. Duroc was cooperative, giving convincing detail. He had precise recall of what he claimed were 156 homicides going back to 2010. He insistently referred to the Lord's work, and respectfully claimed that the Lord's needs were revealed to him by the teachings of the Reverend Modell. "I say, he's going to be a Modell prisoner," snorted Jerome. Through one-way glass, Duroc seemed to be looking at her. He explained how he had schooled Hugh Best to make a confession claiming 5 murders. He took no delight in his crimes, but was punctilious in corroborating his claims. She was sure even a cursory check would confirm everything he said. Jerome's forehead was disfigured by a splotch of hardened healing gel. He was certainly taking his knocks. She was all right, but her shoulders felt as if she had been racked, and her back was scraped raw. She was a real Tina. She had faced the monster and won. She would be around for the sequel. All her hurt was inside. Rob Hackwill was laughing in her dreams, exulting in a victory she did not yet understand. And his devil princess whispered to her. She sometimes looked like Stacy, sometimes like Beth Yatman, and sometimes, horribly, like Chantel Jewelerat, S.J. It was too easy, Chantel said. He got away with it for too long to be stopped by us. He doesn't seem upset or unhappy. Duroc politely refused an offer of recaf or a cigarette. His faith required him to abjure stimulants. He explained the electromagnetic pulse he had used to mind wipe Alan Keyes. Modell called the talent the author of maximum evil, and Duroc had been the instrument of the Lord's vengeance. This is like everything else he ever did, part of his program. The ghetto was clear of Modellists. Prague was pacified for the moment at the expense of armored EDF goons on every corner. As E-Union servants, Chantel and Jerome would have priority when travel restrictions were lifted. For every week their flights were delayed, they were given McDonald's scrip redeemable for a happy meal at any airport in the world. They were alone on the Mayrink. The EDF rapid response team was redeploying to Dublin, where the factionalized followers of so-called anti-Pope James Bacon were firebombing each other. Duroc was all over the news nets, nicknamed the Scourge of God, Modell's Murder Messiah, or Holy Hackwill. He was likely to end his days in the E-Union penal therapy colony on Sicily, shackled in an oubliette. Pyramid announced a drama docudream about his killing spree. In Broadmoor, Beth Yatman changed her plea from Hackwill made me do it to God told me to. In Kiev, the relatives of Hackwill victims reconstituted as the relatives of victims of religious fanaticism changed their lawsuit. Pyramid Releasing and Derek Leach Enterprises were no longer indicted. The new defendants were Reverend Joseph Modell, the Modellist Teleministry, and the state of Liechtenstein. If, under the Modell-Duff law, the case was decided in the favor of RVRF, Modell and his church would be bankrupt, forced to bestow settlements on upwards of 25,000 claimants. Purge survivors all over the E-Union were bringing their own suits against Modell, all because of Roger Duroc. Jerome importuned her for spiritual advice she could not give. Her own faith was not shaky, but she sensed a precedent. If religions were responsible legally for violence done in God's name, what church would still stand in 10 years' time? On the deck of the Mayrink, she walked with Jerome. Suddenly, he kissed her. That was for coming out of the river for me. I've never thanked you. I don't think Duroc would have killed you.
That's not what either of us thought then. She had been going over Duroc's bio, following everything that came out on the news nets. It was important that she understand. It was the same old question. What makes a monster of a man? It started in the Basque insurrection, she thought out loud. He saw what the Modelists were capable of in that carnage, then joined their church. He was a murderer. Modelism was made for him. He wasn't a murderer then. He didn't kill, even in battle, until after he joined the church. Modell brought out something in him. Medea Calm was right. The Reverend should have looked to his own house. The amendment is based on the theory that people can be warped by media mass, that dreaming of Hackwill turns you into him. Duroc proved the theory sound, but established we did not have to worry about what came out of the mind of Alan Keyes, but what we heard in the pulpit and read in the Bible. You can weigh 15 supposed Hackwill killers against thousands of murderers who fancy themselves instruments of a vengeful God. They all learned madness in a church somewhere. Exactly. And I intuit that's the position Duroc wants us to take. Or worse, the truth he wants us to face. He spent 10 years and 156 lives on his design, and he's going to bring down a church that could count itself among the world's great powers. Your lot will probably canonize him. If God's ministers can be brought to trial for the crimes of his followers, Modelism will be only the first church to fall. This morning, Cardinal Menzies had reported that the first lawsuits were being laid against the Vatican. RVRF expanded their claims, charging not only Modelists, but 17 other major churches. Georgi was not handling the impending crisis well. Menzies wanted her in Vatican City. She was their expert on what made people murder. It began to rain, gently at first. I was once told raindrops were God's tears, Jerome said. He has a lot to cry about. Prague rain was rusty, laced with pollutants from 75 years of unregulated factory smokestacks. The Vltava was choppy today. The deck shifted under them. She took Jerome's hand. She needed human contact, something to fix on, some outward manifestation of God's goodness. Though his servants were flawed, creation was a marvel. I'm afraid, Jerome. Chan, churches are built on corpses. Mine most of all. If Kiev upheld Model Dove, the great wealth of the Roman Catholic Church, of all churches within the E-Union, was in peril, there were incalculable economic consequences. I liked him, Chan. I thought he liked us. Despite all the pegs and abjuring, I truly intuited he was a solid fellow. Was he really mad all along? He was trying to teach us a lesson. Maybe he would have had to be mad to try. Maybe, after all, there was a little of Rob Hackwill in him. It's all been about attributions of guilt. It's all been about where the bodies are buried. She gripped Jerome's hand until her knuckles hurt. Soon she would let go, let him go, let Duroc go, let Hackwill go.
Soon she would return to Rome, to her cell, to her faith, to fighting for her church. Soon, the rain began to pelt. Drops drummed the deck like liquid bullets, driving them below. This is a little afterword to the preceding story by Goblin Hood. First of all, I'm going to read part of the little afterword about Kim Newman in the anthology Dark Terrors 2, because it gives a certain amount of information about the story I just read and the one preceding it. The short story collections, The Original Dr. Shade and Other Stories, and Famous Monsters, represent a sampling of the author's eclectic short fiction, while the prequels to Where the Bodies Are Buried, 2020, can be found in our anthologies, Dark Voices 5 and 6, Where the Bodies Are Buried, and Where the Bodies Are Buried 2, Sequel Hook, and the first volume of Dark Terrors, Where the Bodies Are Buried 3, Black and White and Red All Over. According to the author, regular readers of the Bodies series will note that this latest installment is the Where We Came In conclusion of the series. It also takes the world of the Bodies stories, which is more or less the world of much of my recent fiction, including The Original Dr. Shade, Organ Donors, and The Quorum, up to the beginnings of the future seen in some of my earlier science fiction stories, such as Dreamers, Patricia's Profession, and The Nightmare. The Yggdrasil Swallows Its Tail, a Where the Bodies Are Buried collection, is also in the works. Goblin Hood here again. That was written in 1996. And it's 2001 now, 5 years later. If Kim Newman ever did a collection of his Where the Bodies Are Buried stories, I've never seen it. Of the stuff that he just mentioned, I've read The Original Dr. Shade, and I recognize that world because it's the world of the Derek Leach media empire that takes place, or that backdrops both of these Where the Bodies Are Buried stories. I've also read Patricia's Profession, but it seems to have very little connection to these. And I've also read The Nightmare, which most of which took place in sort of a virtual reality universe. Interesting little tale about these two stories that I've been reading on tape. Last month, I had been to the local library looking for horror story anthologies, in particular the year's best horror. I knew they had at least one volume.
volume of it because I'd taken it out of there before. But I didn't know where they kept them, and I'd been looking around and had had to satisfy myself with bringing home several volumes of the year's best fantasy and horror, which they kept in their fantasy section. That's okay. I mean, they've got some good horror in there, but you really have to pick through it. And there were only a few stories in each volume that I wanted to read. So Julia told me, well, she thought there was like an entire section devoted to anthologies themselves. And the next day, or a day or so later, we went there. And in fact, there was a section like that, which turned out to have a really good collection of horror anthologies. Not only including several volumes of the year's best horror, but these two volumes of Dark Terrors, an anthology that I've never seen before. So I got those and a stack of other books, and we went out shopping that day. And while we were at Myers, we happened across a little item thing that she bought me for my collection. It was a toy based on the concept of virtual reality called a VR 3D thing, you know? And it's like 3D is what interests me and what I collect, so I was happy to get it, but I knew it would bear very little resemblance to actual virtual reality. As it turned out, what it reminds me of more than anything is a sort of a video game shooting arcade. Not particularly sophisticated looking. Maybe somewhere between the old Pac-Man type graphics and the more sophisticated graphics of today. But it does have kind of a 3D screen that these little Android things and stuff show up on. It's called Android Attack. It also has spaceships and stars. The closest it comes to seeming like virtual reality is that it amounts to this complicated helmet with earphones and like a screen that comes down over the eyes and that whole thing. So it's actually sort of neat. The game itself is hard to play. It's got like a gun attachment. This is all wireless, by the way. It takes a lot of batteries. And you use the gun to control what's going on the screen. Supposedly, I guess you shoot these little androids with the gun, and it progresses the game along. I can't do it very well. I've seldom managed to hit anything with it. I'm not entirely sure it's in good working order. I don't really know what it's supposed to be like. It's fun. It's kind of neat. It's like, it looks enough like the whole virtual reality rig that I can enjoy having it just on that basis. I'm not interested in it as a game anyway. I'm only interested in looking at the screen with its little form of 3D. But anyway, so I had that, brought it home, and was playing with it, and then decided to sample these books that I'd brought home. And the first story I mean, Kim Newman is one of my favorite short story writers. I'm not as enthusiastic about his novels, but his short stories are exceptionally good. So I read those first. Those were the ones that most excited me, and
Imagine my amazement when, where the bodies are buried, three turned out to center around somebody being obsessed with a 3D video. Just like me, you know. It reminded me of various experiences I've had in video stores where I've been told that 3D videos don't even exist. Whereas the video they described sounds like it's based on the Friday the 13th movies. And there was one of those with 3D segments. There was also a I'm talking about the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And yeah, one of those did have some 3D stuff in it, but there was also Friday the 13th 3. That movie was in 3D. One time Julia and I went into a video store and asked about 3D videos, and the woman there said that Friday the 13th Part 3 was in 3D on video. She turned out to be mistaken. She actually called her distributor and asked and got back to us. She said the only movie ever made in 3D on video was Robot Monster, and it was out of print. She was right that it was out of print, as far as I've been able to tell. But she was wrong about the availability of 3D videos, because there were, so far, I've got The Mask, Catwomen of the Moon, Coming at You, The Bubble, a Kiss video called Psycho Circus, which I recently had the supreme experience of buying in a video store. It's the only one I've ever seen in a video store. The others I either had to order from a catalog or worse yet, had to order off of the internet last year. There are also some roller coaster videos, a video about Alaska, there's some TV stuff. So there's stuff out there. Meanwhile, so that first story, Where the Bodies Are Buried 3, was really exciting to me because it postulated a world where a 3D video could be at the top of the charts in the rental stores. Meanwhile, then I read the second story, and it's actually about a form of virtual reality. The most interesting thing about it was the descriptions of how this mimesis thing worked, and also some of the long passages comparing it to virtual reality of contemporary technology, which made, you know, the current state of the art sound as if maybe it's not all that different from the little toy thing that I've got. You know, the business about Zotsing aliens sounds like the thing that I have to play with. Generally speaking, virtual reality is usually presented in media as if it were some alternate world you wander around in. But as far as I know, all it really is at this point now is a sophisticated way of, I've never actually seen the real thing, but I gather it's just like a headset you put on, and there'll be like a screen in front of you, probably about the equivalent of the little screen thing in my unit, except that there you'd be walking down a hallway and it'll show the hallway as you progress along it. And I guess they have gloves or something you wear, and they allow you to manipulate the hands of the, you know, whatever character you're inhabiting, I guess. But despite the claims of the media, despite the way it's presented in shows like VR5, I don't think it's nearly as sophisticated as, even the, you know, story that I just read, written back in the mid-90s, it talked about the VR parlors of the new millennium, you know, and they just never materialized. As far as I know, virtual reality available to the public is something that you might see at places like COSI in small doses. The fact is, the only thing I've ever seen that came anywhere near to the kind of experience virtual reality is supposed to be, according to like the way it's presented on television and stuff, was the 3D IMAX movie Cyberworld. I mean, there was really something going on there, you know. The characters seemed to like walk right up to you or hang over you or go past your head or almost go through your head. The odd thing there, I mean, there was like a helmet thing. There was like headphones and goggles you put on. The effect there seemed to be contained within the goggles themselves. It was a very strange effect. And of course, the IMAX screen was so huge that it made what was happening seem to take place, you know, seem to be all around you, you know. Anyway, right now I'm just using up the last of this tape. I'm really glad to get these two stories on tape because, well, they have a lot of meaning for me, like I said. Interestingly, the time a couple of weeks back when we went in this video store at the mall where evidently they have some really hard to find stuff, that's the only place where I've ever seen a 3D video for sale. That Kiss video I've got was a limited edition video. Interestingly, it also turned out to be designed for the chroma depth system, which is the kind that I use myself when I'm painting. The glasses and everything. And on the way home from there, we stopped at a local comic book store for the first time around here, the first time I've been in a place like that around here.